From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's much maligned alligator Alcatraz is shutting down. So now what?
No kind of development or intensification of the site can ever happen again.
Also this week, a Republican candidate for Florida governor announces his pick for lieutenant governor and faces immediate pushback over what some say is that pick's anti-black bias.
But it's also an issue with the welfare state that incentivizes a lot of young single black moms to never get married. Why? Because they're going to get more money.
We'll also delve into the special relationship Florida has with its Caribbean neighbors and explore ways to keep vacationing school kids from losing their learning over the summertime break. I'm Tom Flanagan, on air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end of the week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Nearly a year to the day since it opened, the Immigration Detention Center in the Everglades is empty. But as WUSF's Megan Bowman reports, attorneys on a case to shut down the facility say the work isn't done yet.
Center for Biological Diversity attorney Elise Bennett says her biggest concern is it could reopen.
There's a lot of work that needs to be done, not just to undo the harm that's already been done at the site by this facility, but to figure out how to make sure nothing like this, no kind of development or intensification of the site, can ever happen again.
Attorneys return to court soon. Bennett says they want assurances the site is shutting down for good, a public evaluation of all the harm caused, and any damage is cleaned up and paid for. Alligator Alcatraz was built in 8 days last summer. Despite the high cost to contain waste and build the temporary pop-up facility, Governor Ron DeSantis says it was a good use of the state's resources.
There's no question that this mission has made the state of Florida safer. There's no question that releasing some of these folks would have been represented a clear and present danger to the well-being of Floridians up and down the Florida peninsula.
He's always maintained this was a temporary solution and says it will be taken down over the next 2 weeks. I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
Florida Republican gubernatorial candidate James Fishback announced former South Florida police officer Sean Lozano as his running mate this week. Tristan Wood reports the candidate used the announcement to continue racially divisive messaging that's been previously present in his campaign.
Right before officially announcing Lozano as his running mate, Fishback's team posted a body cam video to social media of Lozano chasing down, tasing, and threatening to shoot a black man while working as a police officer back in 2024. During the announcement, Lozano talked about his experience in law enforcement.
I carried a badge in Lauderhill, a city down in Broward County. I worked narcotics, and I went to the places that people avoid their entire life, and I did it on purpose. And let me tell you, I gotta be honest, I love doing it.
Fishback says if elected, he'll crack down on what he calls black-on-black crime. He argues crime in black communities isn't caused by systemic racism or mass incarceration.
I think it's obviously an issue with crime within the black community, but it's also an issue with the welfare state that incentivizes a lot of young single black moms to never get married. Why? Because they're going to get more money being single, getting welfare, as opposed to being married.
Fishback has also used racially divisive language against gubernatorial frontrunner Byron Donalds, who has received President Donald Trump's endorsement. That messaging has garnered a lot of social media attention, but has not yet created momentum in polling. While Fishback has polled decently well with Gen Z Republicans, he's getting less traction with older Republicans, who make up most of the party's Florida voters. Fishback says he's confident about his chances, but was not forthcoming when asked about his plan to win.
I'll keep that to myself. I have a very good strategy. I've gone from 2% to second place in the polls.
Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins and former House Speaker Paul Renner are also vying for the Republican nomination. I'm Tristan Wood.
As earthquakes and hurricanes threaten some Caribbean island communities and political turmoil impacts others, finding ways to preserve their unique identity is a challenge. That's the mission of Caribbean American Cultural Connections. Teddy Byrne talks with the association's president, Omar Berry, about the value of Caribbean American Heritage Month, which is all during June.
What is it about Caribbean culture that makes it so unique. You have a variety of different cultures stretching all the way from Cuba down to Lesser Antilles. It's this melting pot of culture. What is it that just makes the Caribbean as a whole unique from a cultural perspective?
I feel like genuinely it's an organic thing about it. It's like you at some soil, you would take your shoes off. And that energy just hits you from your feet bottom up. That energy makes it so organic that the culture have seen it and has been in that atmosphere. Not just the beaches, we are known for that, but the culture itself. But it's more than just the music, everything makes it a whole. But I'm just saying it's so organic, the feeling to be in that present. You know, you're hearing the dialects, you hear the talk, it's beautiful.
In 2021, you know, Haiti was hit with a massive earthquake and it sent many Haitians to America. And now only a few years later, their status is being removed. What is your emotions when you are seeing people that are coming now, fleeing a bad situation, trying to find a new life in America to continue their cultural traditions, but now might be forced to return to an island that may not be ready to accommodate them when they return?
When it comes on to well, I would just say act of nature and these, you know, earthquakes and devastation of things that happen to people in their home. And they're, you know, coming to be here in America to make better for themselves. As long as the intent is to build, to work, have a skill, what's their mindset coming here? In terms of they coming here from a bad situation, yes, emotionally, to be sensitive towards that, for them to go back where there's nothing there, you know, economy, this, that, you know what I mean? The survival is not a beautiful thing. So I feel like by them being here and being resourceful, they can help to build back home if they only get that opportunity, you know. But the first thing, their intent is, you know, come here to actually work and earn that. It's not about me. As Bob Marley said, if life was for me, I don't want it. You know, so it's about giving and sharing. So people back home, so I feel like when they come here from a bad situation, help them, give them, you know, the opportunity to show that we are one, we are people. It can be done.
Playing with Jamaica last year, the island decimated by a Category 5 hurricane, ruins many of their tourist abilities, and That's a big source of income, and also a place where many of the people who live on the island make their living. They make the living in the tourism industry.
Exactly.
So what do you think should be done to provide support for especially any of the islands in the Caribbean? Do you feel that there should be support from outside nations then to help uplift these countries when they suffer something that was out of their control?
Yeah. Yes, and when they speak of that hurricane that they call Melissa, if I may say, and people right now still have no power. There's people still living in, you know what I mean? There's no home, there's no foundation there. In terms of rebuilding or helping people, I feel like yes, because it's just like similar with Haiti, when there are people in trouble, Jamaica welcome them and take them in, you know. And like it comes back to the whole culture and the heritage, how we help our brothers and my brother keeper. We help each other to build back. One hand washes the other, and that's how people are able to rebuild themselves.
Well, then I know August 1st is Jerkfest.
Yes.
So for anyone that may never have experienced an event like this, what can they expect if they were to come out into Charlotte County, you know, on the 1st of August?
Well, as I can say, it's going to be turn up. As we say in Jamaica, it's going to be turn up. I mean, it's going to be, joyful, blissful, you know, what they can expect. It's just the atmosphere. The atmosphere, the band's playing. You know, and then we want to have like a segment where we have a gospel segment. You know, it's just a phenomenal feeling to be there. The food, as I mentioned earlier, if you are, say, somebody from Trinidad, Cuba, or wherever island they're from, American, see me, because remember, it's Caribbean American cultural connection.
That was Omar Berry, president of Caribbean American Cultural Connections, speaking with Teddy Byrne. Just because the school year has come to an end doesn't mean that learning needs to stop. As kids exchange textbooks and calculators for bikes and beach trips, parents can still do a lot to make sure those young brains stay busy. Eileen Kelly has more on what parents can do to keep educational momentum flowing throughout the summer break.
In case you're wondering, the summer slide isn't the latest TikTok dance trend. No. The summer slide, or maybe you've heard it called the summer loss, is the notion that summer break is bad for kids. That all those efforts to climb academically slide downward come June each year. So could it be that so many gains made during the school year are lost during summer break? Year after year, study after study, previously pointed to this with end-of-the-year testing versus start-of-the-year test. Those tests revealed significant losses. Some studies have said that school children actually lose months' worth of learning. But what if the studies are outdated? What if summer break isn't so bad after all? What if summer break is a good time to nourish oneself with social and physical activities? What about learning without the drudgery of actually feeling like you're back in school? Dr. Paul Van Hippel is an education researcher at the University of Texas. He is challenging those summer slide and summer loss claims. I sat down recently for an interview on Zoom with him and asked him what is his take on the summer slide.
The evidence for the summer slide is not as strong as people think it is. It's not as consistent as people seem to think. There are many studies now that have been done of summer learning. Some find significant summer losses, and many do not. Some find that children go sideways or even gain a little bit during the summer. And these differences seem to have more to do with the way the tests are scored than with anything students are actually learning or forgetting. So I've stopped talking personally about summer learning loss and have started talking about the summer learning opportunity.
Now that sounds promising. So I asked him to tell me about the opportunities.
If you want to pick up a musical instrument and you're not in band already at school, the summer can be an opportunity to get started on that. If you have interests that are either not addressed by your school, you just didn't happen to take advantage of them, the summer is a great opportunity.
But what about children that are truly behind their peers throughout the school year? Von Hippel told me that the train of thought was blaming it on summer break. But he said that's not the entire picture, especially when you track children who started school well behind their peers.
That's right. When I first started doing research in this area, there were some people who were saying that most of the achievement gap between kids who are behind and kids who are ahead is due to summer learning loss. And I no longer think that's true. It really does seem to be there at the start of kindergarten. And it just tracks unless steps are taken to with kids who are behind to get them caught up.
So it sounds like the takeaways are, if your child ended the school year behind, summer is a good chance to try and correct that. And two, no matter if a youngster is advanced or behind, make the most of the summer.
Important to put some structure in place to ensure that your child is seeing other children. So there's social aspect of the summer as well, that they're seeing other children, that they're developing their interests and hobbies, that they're catching up in topics that were causing trouble for them in the last school year, et cetera. I think it's important to sit down with your child and define what their goals are for the summer and see what steps they're going to take toward those goals and have some way to monitor it.
And that sounds like sound advice, TikTok or not. This is Eileen Kelly.
Owning a home in Florida can take a financial toll. According to the Florida Homeowners Guide, the average Florida home needs between $14,000 and $18,000 in annual maintenance. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford sits down with Angie Hicks, the co-founder of Angie, formerly known as Angie's List, to discuss how homeowners can tackle yearly upkeep.
Your company was founded more than 30 years ago in Columbus, Ohio, with $50,000, and it is now a $1 billion home services company. Can you walk us through how you got started and why?
We started the business. My co-founder had bought a house that needed a lot of renovations, and he honestly just had a bad experience with a contractor, and we really thought there should be a better way for homeowners to share information on the contractors they're hiring so that they could benefit from each other's experiences. And that's what formed Angie's List, and that was pre-internet days. You would call in and ask for the name of a plumber, or you talk to me most likely. And then we expanded city by city, mainly started in the Midwest, and then expanded nationally over the first decade or so that we were in business.
And how did it evolve into a billion-dollar company?
Well, quite honestly, we were in business maybe 5 years, and then the internet came along, and that really helped the business take off because it was a really easy way for homeowners to be able to get the names of plumbers, electricians, painters that they might be looking for. So we really expanded there, and we've stayed true to our roots of just being there to help homeowners find great contractors and to really help contractors build their business and allow them to really shine for the good work that they do.
And there was this new global survey. The results were released, and it compares homeowners in the United States to those around the world. What countries were involved, and why is this kind of survey important?
We've spent a lot of time talking about just how U.S. homeowners compare to one another, but we thought, hey, what would be interesting is to find out how we compare to other areas of the world. So we had a number of countries in Europe. We also had a couple of countries in Asia and in South America in order to get a broader perspective on what's happening. And one thing that was, rang true, even though every country was a little different, was that homeowners really view their house as a sanctuary and want to maintain it. You know, it's the place where they, they live every day, they raise their family. So the importance of that decision, that investment, rang true across the globe. But what really stuck out for U.S. homeowners is how we focus on maintenance and really being proactive, which is really important, especially given the economy today.
What findings surprised you most?
Well, what was interesting was that, 72% of Americans renovate their house in order to maintain it. We are very much focused on maintaining our homes. 49% do so proactively, which is great. Really getting ahead of things before they snowball into something bigger. And this is important when you kind of lay it out against the broader picture that we're living in our houses 5 years longer than normal, and we want to make sure that our house can keep up with our changing needs and interests. So that's great. And one interesting stat that came out for Florida in particular is that 56% of Floridians view their home as a financial investment, which is above what we see across the U.S. in general, which is just at 42%.
Now, how do American homeowners differ from other countries when it comes to how we approach homeownership?
Well, U.S. homeowners are very maintenance-minded and want to take care of things before they snowball. So they're making their to-do list and making sure they're checking off things that need to be done around their home, which puts us ahead of other countries in how we think about maintaining.
And what stresses homeowners more in the United States when it comes to upkeep?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the stresses, I mean, it's not going to be surprising per se. Unexpected expense can stress us, unexpected time that we have to spend taking care of these problems. So what I would suggest is that homeowners make a list of items that they want to tackle. Go around, use a critical eye and, make that list independent of your budget. And then start to lay against that list some budget. Start with structural issues. This time of year with hurricane season just getting kicked off, make sure that we've got our homes prepared and ready for that extreme weather. And then tackle them one by one. Don't try to do it all at once, because that's where we can get really anxious for sure when it comes to maintaining our house. And then set aside a budget. A lot of times people think about the cost of owning a home might be their mortgage or their insurance. They should really have a budget for home improvement and maintenance. And that should be about 1-2% of the value of your home. Because if you have that budget, then that helps to reduce that anxiety. You've got the money if the air conditioner goes on the fritz, and you're not stressing about that on top of being just hot.
Now, what should homeowners do if they feel that they've already fallen behind on their repairs or maintenance? What would be your best advice?
Well, if you feel like you're already behind, that's when we just need to kind of start to gain some ground. So start with some small projects to gain some confidence, and do a few as you can. But don't try to do them all at once, because that can be very overwhelming. So start with a few, gain some confidence, and then start with the next round.
That was WGCU's Jennifer Crawford speaking with Angie Hicks, the co-founder of Angie, formerly called Angie's List. According to the National Institutes of Health, dementia affects more than 6 million Americans. As more people are diagnosed, many family members are suddenly thrust into the very challenging role of becoming the main caregivers. Reporter Carrie Barber covers how the caregiver's journey provides free assistance to those living with and caring for a loved one who has dementia.
When a loved one is diagnosed with dementia, a family member may be put into a position they never expected, caregiver. It's a 24/7 job with no training, no pay, and huge stakes. And you're doing it while watching a loved one mentally slip away. But now there's a local resource that can help, the Caregiver's Journey. It was founded by Sue Ryan of Naples and Nancy Treister of Atlanta, because they've both been through this journey, Sue more than once, and they have useful information to share. They began with a podcast.
We started that in August of 2024 to bring answers to questions people had. We specifically made it advice on how to, and we specifically made it, it has to be actionable tips. Somebody's got an issue, they come and they listen, and they're short podcasts. We wanted them to get answers, things they could do within 25 minutes or less. And this is especially true for this topic.
We're all on this journey together. Yes, we are.
The program is now much more than a podcast. It's a robust website with blog posts, downloadable guides, and more.
You don't have to subscribe to anything. Everything is free. Every podcast episode we have, we also create a matching blog, because some people want to read and not listen. So we have that. Every podcast episode has show notes. So if there's anything we refer to it, people can know exactly how to go get something. And we never refer to something that we haven't either used, or if we've got an expert on that they aren't expert in. So we're not promoting anything that is something that somebody's going to make a profit off of.
A good place to start is the Navigating Dementia Roadmap, which walks people through each stage of the disease. It outlines things they may want to take care of at that point, such as updating their long-term care plan, and then points them to resources to help them do that, such as sample legal documents and advice from an elder care expert.
We never want to present anything that we are not really knowledgeable in. And so we bring the experts in, but this is one of the things we do, and they love it too, the experts, when we have them on, we create a template, we create an outline, we create, okay, these are the tips. Let's go through together and figure out what are the most actionable tips that are gonna be the most valuable for our listeners. And we prepare, we walk through it together before we do it. So the experts who come on are in the best position to do exactly that. Be expert, give the advice on that particular topic.
Ryan and Treister are adamant that their resources guide caregivers into quick and simple action.
The thing that Nancy and I do so well together is that we really push each other. It's like, okay, well, why don't we do this topic? That's not the right way of doing it. It's got to be more impactful. That would be too fluff. Or I think this is a more important topic than that is right now. Let's shelve it for things like that. So we really collaborate well to bring out the best of what it is, to have it be the most impactful message.
They've recorded 65 episodes so far. Topics range from when your loved one wanders to creating a support network. They have 40,000 subscribers.
Another metric that we have is we launch the podcast every other Tuesday morning at 5 a.m. Eastern time. And by about 5:05 a.m. Eastern time, we've got 500 or more downloads. So we have people who are waiting for the next episode.
Ryan says she's grateful that a lot of the silence and stigma that she dealt with in her 20s when she was helping her grandmother are letting up.
A lot of these stigmas, a lot of the things that we didn't know, we have solutions for and options for that give people permission to navigate the journey more in the open. and take advantage of things that are available.
The most important piece of advice Ryan has for caregivers is to accept help. Don't try to do it all on your own.
And don't do what I did. I just kept shaving off a little bit of my own self-care. I can do this later. I don't need to go to the gym every day. I can get this done. I promise you, there will come a day when there is nothing left to shave off, and you will really wish that you had prioritized self-care. So from the very beginning, make prioritizing your own self-care, your own self-education, very, very important.
The Caregiver's Journey is available online, completely free of charge. I'm Carrie Barber.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, just about everyone knows how old-fashioned spelling bees work. Ryan Owens, the director of the Institute for Governance and Civics at Florida State University, says he got a call not long ago about a different kind of bee, a civics bee.
The National Chamber of Commerce has been working on this for about 3 years now, and they reached out to me about a year and a half ago and said, hey, we've got this thing called the National Civics Bee. We think it's great. We'd love for FSU to be the host institution for the state championship, and I jumped all over it.
Owen says 6th, 7th, and 8th grade students all over Florida are now involved in the program.
The local chambers will work with the national chamber to reach out to schools across various communities, and they have regional competitions across the state of Florida and, of course, across all the other states in the country. And the winners of those regional ones then get sent to their state championships. So that one, of course, will be here at FSU on June 30th at 4 o'clock in the Turnbull Conference Center.
That championship, says Owens, is open to everyone and should be an exciting event.
Students will get a series of multiple choice type questions up on a big screen. People in the audience will have the ability to play along themselves. So there'll be two rounds of those types of questions, and then there's a third round, which is a little bit more of a question-answer sort of response with the students and with the judges who are sitting there at the dais.
The objective, of course, is to advance to the National Civics Bee in Washington, D.C. this fall. Owen says there are impressive prizes for the winning competitors.
At the state level, the winner will take home $1,000, which is pretty great, but the winners of the National Civics Bee, the first place winner gets $100,000 that they can use towards a 529 college plan. And even second and third place get $25,000 and $15,000.
It promises to be a lot of fun, but Owens says there's actually a very serious objective to the whole affair, to encourage greater civics knowledge for everybody.
From the data, we know that people who have greater civics education are much more politically tolerant, much less likely to play footsie with political violence. They're much more likely to engage civically. And so it's that kind of health that we want to grow in the country today.
Find out more about the Florida finals for the National Civics Bee at WFSU.org. Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Randy Buxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Megan Bowman, Teddy Byrne, Eileen Kelly, Jennifer Crawford, and Carrie Barber. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.